This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. Today we hear a Michigan Republican member of Congress on the Articles of Impeachment.
It doesn't constitute a high crime misdemeanor as envisioned, in my opinion, by the founders.
Are the people whose wells were contaminated by PFAS happy about a settlement that pays to connect them to municipal water supplies?
They want to know what the deal is. They want to know, will they be stuck paying for water they never really wanted?
A retiring journalist in the Lansing Capitol Press Corps reflects on the changes over the decades.
The changes, and especially the economic changes to the industry, have devastated what's being covered here.
And our political commentators on this year's state budget fight.
I think a lot of folks who depend on state funding for their programs, their nonprofits, I think we're really left stranded by the political jockeying that both sides did.
Plus, this is my last show as a regular host on Stateside. We'll look at a couple of my favorite moments on the show. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Later this hour, one of Lansing's longest-serving Capitol reporters is retiring. We'll talk to John Lindstrom of Gongwer News about his nearly half a century as a Michigan journalist. But first, the U.S. House will vote on articles of impeachment next week. Democrats are expected to approve. Most Republicans are expected to vote against them. Republican member of Congress Paul Mitchell of Michigan's 10th Congressional District issued a statement which reads in part, "I believe the founders intended impeachment to be a safety valve to allow removal of a president that acted in such a blatantly immoral and illegal manner as to threaten the base of our republic. After careful examination of the evidence presented throughout this inquiry, I do not believe President Trump's actions constitute high crimes and misdemeanors." Congressman Mitchell joins us now. Welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Okay.
Always good to talk to you.
These two articles of impeachment are: one, President Trump abused the powers of the presidency, and two, he tried to cover up misdeeds by obstructing a congressional investigation. What do you think about the first charge, that abuse of the powers of presidency?
Well, I think the question is, did the president's actions, as they're related to this question of the Ukraine, did they constitute a high crime misdemeanor? I don't believe that the phone call that the president made by including the Burisma and Biden there should have happened. I think that that's something that should not have taken place. A reference should not have been made in any way, shape, or form. But it doesn't constitute a high crime misdemeanor as envisioned, in my opinion, by the founders. As I said elsewhere in my statement, if impeachment becomes a weaponized, if it becomes an electoral tool, this would become the norm around here, that a group of people don't like the rhetoric, the policies, the political approach of the president, and they will look to effectively take him out of office, take him or her out of office. We've had two Democrats already say that if this impeachment fails and the president's reelected, they'll try to impeach him again. They don't know why, but they'll come up with a reason. That is so destructive.
Why do you think asking a foreign government to investigate a political opponent to give Mr. Trump advantage in the coming elections does not rise to the level of abusing the powers of the presidency?
Well, the president asked to investigate corruption, then referenced specifically Burisma, which has been referenced as being a corrupt organization before, in the previous administration, in fact, and then included Biden in that. I don't think it's appropriate, but my statement is clear, which is you have to have a high crime misdemeanor, some blatantly immoral and illegal act that threatens our republic. I don't believe suggesting you want information of a foreign entity makes any sense whatsoever. I think it's inappropriate. But if we're going to approach impeachment in this manner, there's a long list of presidents that should have been impeached for a variety of things that we consider to be offensive. We go back to the days of LBJ and the things he said and did. We can go through a whole long list of people that should have been impeached. There's a reason it should be a rare thing, and it should be something that's abundantly clear. Clearly, with President Nixon, it was appropriate. I mean, let's be honest about it. The list of laws he violated would be as long as your arm and mine. There was any question. You will have a number of Democrats which will not vote for these articles of impeachment, which is unusual. If you look at previous impeachments, there were six Democrats in the House that voted in favor of impeaching President Clinton. There will be no Republicans, I believe, that will vote in favor of impeaching President Trump.
Let me ask you about the second charge, obstructing a congressional investigation. The president ordered his top-level staff and others to ignore subpoenas from the House. Why do you think that's not obstructing a congressional investigation?
Well, it's not obstruction. It's not obstruction until such time as they pursue it legally. And they didn't issue subpoenas. They didn't issue subpoenas to key people. I would have liked to have heard Bolton testify. I would have liked to have heard Giuliani testify. It would have been interesting, to be honest with you. They did not issue subpoenas. They did not pursue subpoenas with the court system. That is how it was done with Nixon, and, in fact, done successfully. The president's entitled to declare or to claim executive privilege. The legislature is entitled to challenge that in the court system, not to simply say, well, you didn't do what we asked you to do, therefore you're obstructing justice. The people that determine obstruction of justice is the court system. They could have gone to the Supreme Court with subpoenas and insisted that they would be upheld. It would have taken some time. And I think, frankly, the reason they didn't is because it would have taken some time. They have a schedule for this. They want this done before the holidays. That's been clear since the inception. You realize that there are, for example, Congressman Green, he called for the impeachment of the president shortly after he was inaugurated. I mean, there are a number of folks on the other side of the aisle that have called for the impeachment of the president and simply looked for the crime. That's not the way our system works.
If, as expected, the Senate does not find President Trump's actions rise to the level of removing him from office, what effects might this have on this and future presidencies?
Well, I think what you're going to – it's already been stated, as I said earlier, that there's a number of the Democrats that said if President Trump is reelected, they will look to impeach him again. I had a conversation yesterday with some members of the Turkish parliament who were in my office. They're here for the NATO parliamentary exchange. And their comment to me was, with our allies, with people around the world, they're asking questions about what's this mean? What's this mean for the president's ability to work with them, his stability? We look unstable in a world that's already unstable enough. And again, I think that's why the founders wanted this to be a very rare act of only the most critically important and blatantly wrong things that an executive could do. Britain had a different system previously, which is why we changed ours when we did our constitution, because they had impeachments willy-nilly and caused all kinds of turmoil there.
Let me ask you one more question. We've only got a couple of seconds
here.
You've been critical, very critical of the president in recent months, particularly of his rhetoric. Do you think he should be president for another term?
Well, my comments about the president go back well before recent months. I shortly, during Charlottesville, I made comments about, no, they're not very fine people on both sides on that. I'm sorry. So it's not recent months. It's when I found it appropriate that I thought the president had said or taken some action I thought was not appropriate. I made media comments. Other occasions I've talked to, I called the White House and I've talked to the president. It's the decision on the presidency is up to the American people. They made one, that decision in 2016. It should not simply be undone by Congress because they don't like him. As you've indicated, the president said some things that I don't like, that I don't appreciate, that I don't think are the best way to approach it. I spoke out against what happened in Syria recently as well, because I thought it was a wrong way to approach it. But you don't just impeach people because you think their Twitter, their political tactics, their rhetoric offend you. I mean, that's our standard. We're not going to keep a president long.
Well, I'll ask you a personal question. Will you vote for him in 2020?
I will. First, yes, I think I will. The question comes down to, I think the question for the American people comes down, I think the president may well win. So this impeachment outcome has been interesting in terms of what's done in polling, where in Michigan the president leads. I just saw a poll, it was Harris poll, I think. I just saw a poll that had the president up at Michigan, another poll, of Michigan up by 5 points over Biden, 6 points over Sanders, and 9 points over Elizabeth Warren in Michigan. In Wisconsin, he's up 9 points over Biden, 13 over Sanders, and 12 over Warren. Think about that. That polling was done December 3rd through 5th. I think this whole process runs the risk of reelecting the president by virtue of the fact the American people are sick and tired of it.
Paul Mitchell is a Republican representing Michigan's 10th congressional district. Congressman, thanks for your time.
Have a good day.
On Monday, we'll hear from Democrat Alyssa Slotkin on her views on impeachment. This week, the shoemaker Wolverine Worldwide reached a tentative settlement with townships near Rockford, Michigan. It amounts to more than $69 million to connect township residents with municipal water systems. Many homes in the area found their private water wells were contaminated with toxic PFAS after material was put in a nearby dump decades ago. Here to tell us more about that is Michigan Radio's Bryce Huffman. Hi there.
How's it going, Lester?
Just fine. So how are these residents responding to this announcement?
Well, I've spoken with residents, and they're actually in favor of the agreement. They like the fact that Wolverine is going to pay for the water extensions. They like the fact that the state and townships were involved in coming up with the plan. But I spoke with a resident named Kimberly Connor. She says there's more she wants to know.
Going forward, what regulations are going to be put in place to make sure that water is safe?
Some other questions I heard from residents are, will Wolverine cover the water bills? These residents who are on wells will be getting city water that they really never planned to pay for. They want to know what the deal is. They want to know, will they be stuck paying for water they never really wanted? I also heard questions about the continued maintenance for the water systems.
Right.
And the townships are going to actually be dealing with that.
So when will municipal water be finished? When will they get hooked up?
The first people to get the water lines are going to be those living with wells most affected, according to Wolverine. But they did make sure to say that some people with higher PFAS concentrations might not get their water lines as early just because of the logistics of actually extending the water system. The plan is for it all to be done within 5 years.
5 years?
And for the most part...
That's a long time.
Yeah, 5 years. In the meantime, Wolverine says they'll be trying to get people other sources of water. But... like I said, 5 years, you know, that's a long time to go without having the access to water that you want to have.
Yeah, right. I imagine there are some people not exactly pleased with that. So what does this mean for these Wolverine lawsuits? I mean, some of these same people have lawsuits against that company.
So I know that Wolverine has two class action suits and dozens of individual lawsuits against them regarding PFAS. I spoke with Cody Angel yesterday. He co-founded the citizens group Michigan Demands Action Against Contamination. He says the state's agreement might actually make a template for other lawsuits to come.
So I think this kind of sets a tone of how these lawsuits are going to play out in the future. It definitely gives way to the legality that they're going to be held responsible for the contamination that they've caused.
Wolverine says it will keep defending itself in court, but I think a lot of residents that I talked to are getting the feeling that more lawsuits could be coming now that Wolverine admitted fault in a way by agreeing to pay for these water extensions.
That'll be interesting to watch. That is Michigan Radio's Bryce Huffman. Bryce, thanks for the time.
Thank you so much, Lester.
Coming up, we're going to take a look back at one of my favorite projects on Stateside, Artisans of Michigan. We'll showcase a segment from that series, so after the break, we'll visit with a blacksmith near Quincy, Michigan. You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. One of the longest-serving journalists in the Capitol Press Corps is retiring. John Lindstrom, the publisher of Gongwer News Service, joins us now. Hi there, John.
How are you, Lester?
So how long have you been reporting events in the great state of Michigan?
In all its various forms, getting on close to 50 years.
Wow.
But, from college on up.
I understand you started working with Gongwer in 1977. That was the first time around, as mm-hmm. I understand it. What was the Lansing Press Corps like back then?
A lot bigger. It's a function of what's happened in the industry as a whole. The Free Press had 3-4 people. The News had 3-4 people. Booth Newspapers, which is now M Live, had at the time, I think, 6-7, and eventually went up to almost 15. WJR had a reporter up here all times, Tim Jones. All the Lansing stations had a reporter here present. Channel 4 out of Detroit had Tom Green. He was here all the time, and the CBS and ABC affiliates would move people up here frequently. There was us. There was our competitor in a nascent form. They were on average about 45, close to 50 people.
How many today?
In terms of total press corps presence, we are down to maybe 15. I mean, the Associated Press, for example, where my wife used to be a reporter, they had 5 reporters and a photographer. The UPI had 3 reporters and a photographer. UPI doesn't have a bureau here anymore, and AP's down to 1. So that just demonstrates how much the changes, and especially the economic changes to the industry, have devastated what's being covered here.
Well, I did a little checking on you with a reliable source you just named, your wife, Cynthia Kyle, to see if I could get some good or funny stories about you. And she says, you tell the funny stories, but you're rarely the topic of them. But she did ask me to ask you about the quote board. What was the quote board?
Oh, God, the quote board. Some 40-something years ago. In fact, this is I'm now the guardian of the quote board, which is on the Dead Sea Scrolls are in better shape, actually, than the quote board, because it was typed out on what we used to call Yellow Dog, which was the cheapest paper you could get. And it's all frayed. But the quote board, a couple of reporters, one of them was then Bob Berg, who was later chief of communications for Governor Milliken, were sitting there, and some senator was speaking, and he said something that made absolutely no sense. And so they decided to type it up, and they called it Words to Live By, and they stuck it up on the board. And then it became something that, you know, people back then, before people used talking points and never changed what they were saying, when they just spoke their own minds and said whatever they wanted to say, people would invariably say strange, silly, and dumb things. And we would tack them up and put them up on what was the quote board.
Got an example or two?
Mary Stallings Coleman, who was the first woman elected to the state Supreme Court, was swearing in a fellow named Abe Lincoln. It was Everett Lincoln. He was elected in a special election to the House, and she talked about what an honor it was and how our democracy was a three-way street, which you have to think about that for a moment. There was, I can't remember if it was, I think it was Art Cartwright. Back in the 70s, there was a great deal of concern about the world's ozone section, and he said, how do we know this deodorant is killing our Ozarks? I just remembered one out, and now U.S. Senator Debbie Stabenow, when she was in the House, said, we know that 90% of the felons in prisons were once children. where the other 10% were, we don't know. She obviously meant to say abused children, but, you know, that kind of got left out. There was a reporter who had come in from the Wall Street Journal during one of the many recessions, which was the worst recession since the Great Depression, to do a story about what horrid shape we were in. And this is back in the days of typewriters, and he was pounding away at a typewriter in the press section and got up to stretch and have a smoke, which you could do back then, and took a look at the quote board and started laughing, and he started writing all these things down, and the Wall Street Journal did a feature on it. And then all of a sudden, Carson was quoting it on The Tonight Show. In fact, they asked us to send a copy of it to The Tonight Show staff. George Will still occasionally quotes late Senator Harry DeMaso, who said, from now on, I'm watching everything you do with a fine-tooth comb.
You know, you've seen a lot of history in Lansing. You know, one of those significant things to happen is term limits. How have term limits changed governing in Michigan?
Not for the better overall. And it's interesting that now we're starting to see groups of people starting to come together saying, well, if nothing else, we need to change how term limits work. By and large, it's made it very difficult for people to develop bipartisan relationships. People have asked me, what would it take to get legislators, and not just legislators, but members of Congress, to work together better? And I've said, get them drunk. And I'm dead serious about that in many respects. I mean, at one time, when I first started, the legislature met on Monday nights. And that was basically just to make sure that everyone was in town. At that time, it was pretty rare for people to go back to their districts every night. Now, unless you live in the UP, pretty much everyone does. It doesn't matter how far they have to drive every day, they do. But they all had apartments or houses they rented down here, and they would stay. So they get here on Monday nights. The Monday night session was... You know, they do a couple of pro forma bills, get that underway, and then they'd all go out and they get together. And they either go to a bar, they go to somebody's house, and they would just talk about things. And even people that didn't drink, you know, like former Speaker Bill Ryan was probably the most significant legislator in state history, they would get together and they would just talk over issues, and they would talk over procedures, and they would talk over how you do things and who you talk to learn about stuff and what kinds of things they should know about. Democrats, Republicans, both did this. It was an incredible learning experience. You can talk to folks who were there during that time. They would talk about just the stuff they got listening to people and learning how they needed to go approach these issues, find out about things. I give you an example. When Bill Faust, God love him, former Senate Majority Leader, great guy, was retiring, and sadly died shortly after he did. I asked him, well, if a new legislator came in today, what is the one thing you would tell them they absolutely have to do? And he said, read the Constitution. And I said, well, Bill, they swear an oath to the Constitution, don't they know it? And he said, no, they don't. Most of them never read the Constitution. So if nothing else, I will say to any people who want to be in the legislature or serve in public government, read the Constitution. Read the Constitution of the United States, state of Michigan. Read your city charter, for crying out loud. So you've got to know what the rules are before you can play the game.
What are you going to miss about the job?
Well, there's the camaraderie, of course, that you have working with folks who go through the same kind of nonsense that you do. There's the adrenaline part of it. There's the sitting on top of a big story aspect of it, which I think every one of us in the business understands. That there's no bigger high than when you're working a big story, when you're on top of it. There's just nothing like it. You in some respects become more important than the story itself, because you're the person reporting it. You're the person getting the facts together and putting it out. And that is something that, it's just really, really hard to give up. I mean, in many respects, I'm always going to be a reporter. You know, just as a priest is always a priest, a doctor is always a doctor. You're a reporter, you're always a reporter.
What are you going to do with your time now?
Try not to be bored, I guess. I've got some projects. I've got some things. I've got some stories I would like to...
How about you if you ask Cynthia? She's got some projects for you, too.
Yeah, I know. I keep hearing about that. That decluttering thing. I think it would be easier just to turn the house upside down and over a giant dumpster and be done with it. There's some stories I'd like to pursue, stories that I've had in mind wanting to do for quite some time, some of them. And the problem is that they are going to take an enormous amount of reporting work to get done. And it's the kind of thing where, given the nature of what we cover and how we have to cover it, you can't just turn around to someone and say, okay, take 2-3 months off so that you can pursue this story. So there's a few things that I want to work on, and hopefully if I get them nailed down, hopefully somebody will be interested in them. So
that doesn't sound like retirement. That just sounds like a different job. So.
Well, in many respects, what I'm doing is I'm stop punching a clock. As publisher, you're not only a reporter, you obviously have to handle the business end of things. And for all its charm, being on deadbeat patrol and having to call up somebody and say, hey, how are you? How's the wife? How are the kids? You ever going to sign that check and send it to me or what? That gets a little old after a while. So it's time now for someone else to take on that task.
John Lindstrom, who's been covering the news of Michigan at the Capitol longer than just about anyone around, he is retiring. Hey, John, I want to offer you a personal thank you. I've visited your office a couple of times just to try to better understand how Lansing worked, and you were always really generous with your time and very helpful. So thank you, sir, and have a great time in retirement.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. During these 4 years of hosting Stateside on Friday, I launched two projects. One was the Cheers to Michigan with Tammy Coxon, and it's been suggested those might continue into 2020. The other project was Artisans of Michigan. For 3 years, with Lindsay Scullin's help, we looked for artisans across the Michigan radio listening area and brought them to you. Our first report was from Northville at Cobbler's Corner, where we visited Tony Piccoli.
It's keeping what you got. If you made the initial investment, why not keep it? If the shoe fits, repair it.
I just visited Piccoli a couple of months ago. He just won another national award for his work. Artisans of Michigan included an ash basket maker, stained glass artist, musical instrument makers, blacksmiths, a fancy lady's hat maker, a World War II airplane restorer, and a guy who makes chopper motorcycles and happens to have his own artisan show on PBS called A Craftsman Legacy, Eric Gorges. In all, we talked to 45 artisans. One of my favorite artisans of Michigan was from near Quincy, and here it is. Michigan. We're outside the blacksmith shop of Joel Sanderson of Sanderson Iron. That putt-putt sound you hear is a one-cylinder engine.
The engine was made in 1898. All the machines are powered by it, the lights, the air compressor.
What's the machinery called that drives everything?
There's a line shaft that runs in the engine room, and there are three other line shafts in the shop with belts coming down to the different machines.
Tell us how that's different from electric motors.
Well, the machines themselves are essentially the same. A lathe's a lathe, but instead of having a motor built into the lathe, there's a belt that comes down from an outside power source. But the machines really haven't changed much since they first came out.
So the big question is, why?
It's fun. It's neat. The machines that I have are tailored for what I do. Okay, so everything in there has a specific function. And the best machines for forging are from this era.
Well, let's go inside.
Yeah.
We walk through a small office, the quietest place in the shop. The complex takes up space in three connected wooden farm outbuildings. Then we enter the engine room.
Oh, that's beautiful.
This is straight out of the 19th century. The single arm of the piston turns a pair of 6-foot flywheels painted red. A complex series of shafts and belts throughout the shop are powered by this one contraption. In the main shop, nearly all the machinery is a century old or older. Drill presses, lathes, saws, grinders, and so on. The belts continuously spin, but they don't go into action until Sanderson engages a machine. At the center of everything is a cast iron forge which belonged to Sanderson's great-grandfather.
How did you begin doing this work?
I built a fire. I heated some iron and I hammered it.
No, I mean, seriously. Why did you do that?
Because it's what I wanted to do. And I'm not trying to be a joker here, but I was 14 and I wanted to just play with the iron. So I did, and I did that for 14 years. During that time, I worked for different people. And when I was 28, I went out on my own and I started making ironwork.
He'd gone to college, studied industrial arts, mechanical drawing, metallurgy, and machining. After that, he worked at a couple of blacksmith shops, famous ones in the business, one in Ohio and another in New York.
The only job I've ever had has been blacksmithing.
You make furniture. Your style is, you definitely know it when you see it. Oh, what do you call it?
Well, thank you. I don't know if it has a category. The way I work involves a lot of different mechanical processes, a press, a shaper, power hammers, and so a lot of it is built around my studio that I've accumulated over the years. I have, 28 machines here, all specific for certain processes, and without them I kind of handicap. So they've influenced the way my work looks as much as my skill with them and around them has.
Despite the 19th century mechanical influence, some of Sanderson's ironwork is at least in part inspired by the Art Nouveau movement. It's about forging iron into nature, the curve of a plant, for instance. There's also an Art Deco influence in some of his pieces, but his style is mostly influenced by improving on the last piece he did.
The design starts with an idea from whatever I'm inspired by. Then I work it out on paper. And I might draw 5, 6, 8, 10 tables or versions of a table before I choose one that I really like. Then I draw that full size on the floor. If I still like it, I calculate the volume in every part, figure out how much steel to cut to make that shape, and then I make the parts based on the drawing on the floor. Of course, in order for it to be free, it has to be able to take its own life beyond that two-dimensional sketch on the floor. So that's the starting point. Then the finish is when it comes together and I decide if I want to make this or that different to make it more alive.
Sanderson says you can't design on the fly when you're working with red hot iron. You've got to have a plan, and you've got to capitalize on what you know.
I have a lot of parts that I can make relatively efficiently and use them in different combinations to communicate different things and to come up with a unique piece. No two finished pieces are alike, but they will share elements.
He says mostly he makes tables that he sells through galleries. Beer Art Gallery in Charlevoix, Toledo Museum of Art, Highlight Gallery in California. He says they keep him pretty busy, but he does do some custom work for people, things like railings and lighting. People seem to like to have handcrafted pieces forged by someone they can identify.
As we're moving away from the mid-20th century industrialism, which was, of course, a result of World War II's efficiency and straight-line grossness, we're now moving towards the handmade, the homegrown. You know, we have farmers markets now springing up, so we have alternatives to the mass-produced items, foods. And the same is true with building. People are hiring small firms, Amish, to build houses, you know, instead of big firms, you know. And same with the craftsmen. The crafts are coming back, and people want that handmade life in their home and not the mass production that we've seen for too long.
Fascinating furniture from a fascinating blacksmith shop. That's Joel Sanderson of Sanderson Iron, our latest artisan of Michigan. Still to come, Governor Gretchen Whitmer and the Republican-led state legislature are finding solutions to their months-long budget impasse. That's next on Stateside. Stick around. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. After Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer rejected much of the budget sent to her by the Republican-led legislature, there's been a lot of negotiation on supplemental spending and about the governor's powers to shift spending in the state. Here to talk about this year's interesting budget process are our Friday political commentators, Ken Sikkema, who is Senior Policy Fellow for Public Sector Consultants. He's also a former Republican Majority Leader of the Michigan Senate. And T.J. Buchholz, who's President of Vanguard Public Affairs, a progressive political strategy firm. He worked for Governors Engler and Granholm and headed up communications for Lieutenant Governor John Cherry. Ken, what do you think is the big takeaway, the lesson to be learned from this year's budget fights?
Well, yeah, I really see this last year and the budget being first and foremost. I really see the last year as kind of a year of testing each other. All these leaders, Speaker, Majority Leader, the Governor, it's not just that they're new to their positions. It's also kind of in the context that you have very forceful personalities with very strong political and ideological and philosophical beliefs that they want to advance. And I just think it was a year of testing. How far could you go? How's the other side going to react? How do you respond? And I think hopefully, and I think they're not going to do it this way again because they learned some things. But that's how I see it, as more of a year of testing.
TJ, what do you think the governor and the legislative leaders should think about after this year's budget struggles?
Well, I certainly think it was a very acrimonious year, and I think a lot of folks who depend on state funding for their, you know, programs, their nonprofits, I think were really left stranded by the political jockeying that both sides did. At the end of the day, though, I do agree with Ken. I hope they've learned some lessons, and, you know, the state cannot afford another process like this, just from a trust in government perspective. I mean, I think outside people who just watch this casually just see, you know, division and derision among the two parties, the Republicans and Democrats, and it just drives people further apart. And we should be trying to work together toward common goals. And given the fact that we may have some, you know, rougher economic waters on the horizon, I think it's more important that they work together better than they have in the past.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think generally voters just want government to work most of the time. So I want to ask you about a couple of budget issues. First, road funding. Ken, after all the talk about fixing the roads in last year's campaigns and this year's legislative session, we ended up with what?
Well, that issue fell off the table here as they finally negotiated a budget agreement. And they're going to have to revisit it because, if anything, the roads are probably going to be in worse shape next year. So, but it kind of fell off the table, and it's going to have to be revisited.
TJ, next year is an election year. What's the future of road funding in that scenario?
Well, Governor Whitmer has already said, and I think she came out this morning saying that she is planning another run at Rhodes. She has to. I mean, it was the signature issue for her to get elected on. You know, she pushed an issue that she knew was not popular, but she also knew would fix our short-term problem. I think after January, we'll see Rhodes front and center for the governor. I would suspect that that's a critical message for her in the state of the state, and she'll try again. Again, we can't keep neglecting our infrastructure. And we talk a lot about roads, Lester, but it's not just roads. It's cities and villages. It's local units of government. It's mental health. It's even education. We have to talk about some long-term fundamental solution for our infrastructure problems. And I think she'll come out strong in January with another road plan.
The second budget issue, probably not as important to most people as roads, fixing the roads, but it's Pure Michigan. That state-funded tourism campaign has been zeroed out for this year. Ken, some Republicans say the tourism industry ought to be funding that anyway. What do you think?
Well, they're going to have to wrestle that beast to the ground, meaning do you fund it with public dollars or do you fund it with special assessments on businesses and industries that benefit from tourism advertising? And I think there's a big philosophical issue that has to get resolved before they decide, you know, is it $30 million or $20 million or whatever.
TJ, the tourism industry is more than a little disturbed about defunding Pure Michigan. What kind of real impact might it mean, though?
Well, I think Pure Michigan is a proven advertising and marketing campaign for the state. And again, the industry can point to, you know, the sort of ROI and the investment, the dollar that the state spends. You know, we get billions back in tourism dollars. So, I do believe strongly that this is a philosophical issue that's been bubbling up for some years about who pays for this program. And, I think that you'll probably see some sort of hybrid at the end of the day. I don't think Pure Michigan is going anywhere in the long run, but I do think that they do need to wrangle who's going to pay for it and who benefits from the program. I think at the end of the day, everybody benefits, but the question, as it always is who's going to pay for it.
Gentlemen, this is my last appearance as regular Friday host on Stateside, and I want to say I don't know that we solved any of the state's problems, but I think we certainly explained a lot of them over the years. TJ, it's been a real pleasure talking to you over the last several months, and Ken, we've been chatting nearly every Friday for 4 years. I've always been impressed with your thoughtful analysis, and I really mean that sincerely. I never know where you're going on an issue, and you've often caused me to see things differently, so thanks for that.
Well, it's been a pleasure chatting with you over the last several years. It's also been a pleasure, frankly, to chat with TJ in the last several months.
Yeah, I also want to give a shout-out to two of our long-time commentators, Vicki Barnett and Susan Demas, who also sparred with you a little bit, Ken.
Yeah, they did. That's true.
Hey, Lester, thanks a lot for the opportunity. It's been great to talk with you. And, you know, to get to talk about political issues with somebody as prominent as Ken Sekema is a real pleasure for me. So, again, thanks for everything, and best of luck to you and your next adventure.
Well, yeah, that's going back to one job here at Michigan Radio with the Environment Report, so I'm thrilled about that. Ken, TJ, have a great weekend.
Hey, thanks, Lester. You too.
Thanks, Lester.
Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings. I'm Lester Graham, and this is another episode of Cheers to Michigan. I see a bottle of rye. I can't think that this is going to go badly.
We do both like rye. So today I'm making the long arm of the law. So this is a recipe that I found a bunch of years ago when I was researching recipes for one of my Made in Michigan classes. And I found the description of this on the Detroit City Distillery website. I didn't have any proportions, so I just kind of winged it. I have no idea if this tastes like what it tasted like when they made it, but I like it, and it's become a fall go-to drink for me.
And you're using their rye, too.
Of course. It has 1.5 ounces of the Detroit City Distillery rye, and then it's got 3/4 ounce of lemon juice, because it is a sour. It's got 1/2 ounce of cinnamon syrup, which is acting as a sweetener for the drink and bringing some of those fall flavors. And then the thing that makes it really different is it has a spoonful, bar spoon, teaspoon of fig preserves.
Well, that sounds nice, and I want to try it because it looks delicious, too. You got a nice little cinnamon stick in there, too. Very fancy. It's very well balanced. It's a little sweet for my taste.
I don't think it's sweet at all. I think it's really nicely balanced. Using preserves and jams and cocktails can definitely change the mouthfeel of them. They add some body to it, which might be a little bit of what you're picking up.
I also think the cinnamon makes me think of sweet.
That makes a lot of sense, actually. Because I did use that jam in there, and because figs have little seeds in them, I did double strain this drink. So that meant that after I shook it, I strained it with my regular Hawthorne strainer, and then I used like a tea strainer or a fine mesh strainer to strain it out into the glass so that we didn't get those little floaty bits. It's just a nicer presentation, but if you like floaty bits in your drink, you obviously don't have to do that.
I'd take this drink either way, I think. So have you tested this out on anybody else?
I use it a lot in my private events, and one of the things I really like about it is there are a lot of people who don't like whiskey, or at least think they don't like whiskey, and this is one of those cocktails that even somebody who comes in thinking they don't like whiskey actually tends to like this drink, so it's a good gateway.
That's the long arm of the law. Cheers.
Cheers.
During my time on Stateside, the producers seemed to like to challenge me. They prodded and pushed me into interviews that I thought were either uninteresting or pointless, and then sometimes they ended up being fascinating. I also don't like to do interviews in areas where I don't have a lot of knowledge, and that was the case when Mercedes Mejia wanted me to do an interview with a group that played world music. I tried to explain to her, this is not going to go well. I know next to nothing about world music. Cynthia Candy would do this so well, and she should do the interview. Nope. Mercedes wasn't having any of that. I could refuse, but the band was already scheduled to come in, so fine. I'll do the interview. It ended up being the most fun I've had in the studio. The band was A La Freak.
I've done all that I can do to get along with you. I'm gonna take you to your mama. Payday, payday, payday. Gonna take you to your mama. Payday.
Mark Palms played the fretless banjo, and Kofi Amaya, who played some of the Ghanaian percussion instruments, inspired a trip to Ghana which played a big role in their then recently released CD titled Payday. Kofi is from Ghana. He and his brothers were featured on the CD, and I asked him how it felt being home and playing music with them.
It just felt natural because when I was there, that's pretty much what we were doing. The one person would start playing, and you know, a minute there would be 2-5 people, and then they keep building up. So Mark was able to experience that when he was there. When I was there, I was just used to it. So I wanted him to get a feel of how we used to live.
Mark, you took some recording equipment with you to Ghana. Were you just planning to catch some of the music for reference later, or did you have a CD in mind from the start?
Well, I didn't really have a CD in mind. I had one of those little Pro Tools M boxes, a couple of microphones, and I'm always trying to dig further into traditional music, so I knew that there was a relationship to the banjo in Africa, and I thought, well, gee, I'll just bring these microphones and see what I can collect.
Now, you let these recordings sit on the shelf for a while, and then you headed to New Orleans. Why New Orleans to do a mix for the CD?
Well, I've always felt that there's a strong connection with Africa and New Orleans and Louisiana with Zydeco music and jazz. And I've always wanted Kofi to get down to New Orleans and experience the music. I wanted them to experience his music. And so I had some recording time in the studio. My daughter lives in New Orleans. Natalie's a singer-songwriter, and I told her, gee, do you think we could come down there and grab some New Orleans musicians? And she said, okay, Dad, what do you need? I said, oh, a couple of horn players. And so she grabbed some local guys, and we just really did. We brought that New Orleans element into the music right on the spot in the studio. So it was a bit of a risk, but it really worked out.
Now, you brought in Matt Calloway of Detroit for guitar as well. So you've got that Ghanaian, Nolans, Motor City mix. what did all those parts add up to you?
Oh, well, that's the thing that I was really hoping for, was that connection with Detroit, with Michigan jazz as well as New Orleans jazz. And Matt, you know, he graduated from Wayne State University. He's very accomplished. He's played in my Cajun Zydeco band, and so I know the kind of talent and versatility he has. Hey, he's young, and he said, sure, you know. I'll take it on. So we brought them along.
I want to talk about the instruments just a little bit. Kofi, let's start with you. Tell me a little bit about the instrument you play. It's an ancient mallet-based instrument. What's it called, and what makes it unique?
The instrument is called djel, and it's from Ghana, specifically the northern part of Ghana. And it's played by a few groups of people, and I've actually come across two, the Sisala and also the Dagara people, even though they share the same, they almost like the same instrument, but sometimes different tuning. And it's made from a frame, you know, like a wooden frame, and on top of it are 15 keys, and each of these notes are tuned to a gourd underneath it. And I'm going to show you, it's tuned from high to low. And the lower key has a bigger gourd, and the highest pitch has a smaller gourd.
Right. There's a unique buzz to this instrument, though, that I don't think people are accustomed to hearing.
Yeah, that is the most unique thing about this instrument. And some people are still not used to it, so we always try to explain why we did that, because it was intentionally done. On the gourd, there are three holes cut on it. And traditionally, it's covered with a spider's egg sack case. I mean, I know it sounds a little yucky, but I started using a different paper from the UPS because it's similar to that. I just, rip it from the UPS envelope and I cover it with it. And what happened is when you strike the key, the air travels to the gourd and it wants to come out. So it pushes the white paper that we, is on the gourd, and it creates the buzzing effect.
So what's the reason for the buzz? I mean, why do you want that effect?
We want it because we believe when it vibrates or when it buzzes, it causes some sort of vibration. And traditionally, we believe that there is water in our body, and sometimes it balances that, and it creates healing to the body. And I know people have similar beliefs here because you sit on massage chairs and you get vibrating, all that vibrating
exactly.
effect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So most of African instrument has some sort of even the drums. Either they will have a snare on it to create a buzzing, or the xylophones will have something like this to create the vibe. So it's very to the African people. It means a lot.
Mark, I wanted to talk about your fretless banjo. Mm-hmm. I think most people are familiar with a fretted banjo, but you don't. This instrument is quite a bit different than others I've seen. What's the history with it, and why did you decide to take that with you on your trip to Ghana?
Well, I've always enjoyed playing the banjo, and I like to play this mountain clawhammer style. And I learned about the origin of that really was from African American slaves that brought over banjos made with gourds. And so you get this. You get kind of a nice percussive sound, and you have to slide into your notes. And I think it's really expressive. So I just took this as an opportunity to play this instrument and go to the origin of the instrument.
Well, let's hear how they sound together, the djel and the fretless banjo.
Okay.
Mark Palms and Kofi Amaya, and thank you very much for coming in, guys. Appreciate you bringing your instruments in as well.
Oh, thanks, Lester.
Today's Stateside was directed by April Van Buren. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Laura Weber Davis, and Mercedes Mejia. I want to thank them, as well as the many interns who worked on the show, as well as our former colleagues, Allie Billings and Lindsay Scullin, for putting up with me. They've all been great. I also want to thank my co-host, Cynthia Canty. We've commiserated and celebrated Stateside. She's retiring after 40 years in broadcasting at the end of this month. I wish her all the best in her retirement. I'll still be at Michigan Radio. I'll be spending all my time with the Environment Report, which has, in one form or another, been part of Michigan Radio for 23 years now. Most of the 4 years I spent on Stateside, Rusty Brock has been my engineer, who usually did a fine job, but when he screwed up, what was his response?
Well, that's good enough for Lester.
Yeah, thanks. As always, Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.